Arm's Length Reporting for investors who want the whole story. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
Hey, welcome in KER Politics Time. You know, there's a lot of things going on in the country right now that are certainly, at the very least, thought-provoking. The least of is nationalism versus globalism. The reason I say that is because when you get into the situation that Trump is deeply involved in right now with the tariffs, specifically most recently Mexico and China, that is really a nationalistic issue, in my opinion. And I think that the reason we're getting so many negative comments about what Donald Trump is doing is I think all of those comments, I mean, it's a pretty well-known fact right now that the Democrats are pretty well entrenched in globalism. I happen to be looking out for America, as I think most of you folks are also. Chris, let's talk about that subject. I have Mr. T on the line, Chris Temple. Chris went way out of his way to accommodate you folks so that you could get his views on this very, very important subject. Let's start out talking about the tariffs, Mr. T.
Well, first of all, Al, as far as your comment, I just want to clarify something. The Democrat Party, by and large, has been far more supportive for years of the goals that President Trump claims to have than has the Republican Party been. It's been the Republican Party that has been more for internationalism when it comes to economics and globalization, unfettered capitalism the world over. The Democrats have fought that. The interesting thing these days is that a lot of Democrats want to criticize Trump for, in his own ham-fisted way, trying to do what they've been pining for years, not because they disagree with the policy as much as just they hate Trump. So that said, one of the things that we're going into this weekend with is the question of Mexico. And a week ago when I was talking to Corey about that, I expressed my opinion that the president did a very stupid thing by threatening tariffs on Mexico as a means of fighting illegal immigration. It's like, and I've used this term before in a little bit different context, it's like having a cancer patient and you're treating them for a broken leg, or it's like you're a surgeon, you should have a sharp scalpel and you're using a screwdriver or a butter knife. It just doesn't work. And thankfully, and the reason why there's been such a rally in the markets at the end of the week is that it looks as though cooler heads are going to prevail. And yeah, for a variety of reasons, the president's going to get pushed back on that. As far as the broader subject, however, I think that he had, and he lost it with this Mexico thing, but prior to that, he had really regained a lot of political capital and diffused a lot of his critics by isolating the, and it's not just a trade war. You and I talked about this a while back. It goes beyond that.
Yep.
This long-term conflict with China, which has a lot more to do, as I said, than sneakers and soybeans. So this is something that's going to go on for a while. This month is going to be pivotal. I mean, things can go either real bad or real good in the wake of the G20 meeting, which now is going to include concerns about things beyond even China. We've got Russia that we're trying to fight an energy war with where trade is concerned, and not to mention some other things.
I happen to agree with you 100% on the reasoning behind the tariffs regarding Mexico. I think you're talking apples and oranges here. And I'm rather surprised that President Trump, I think that was an emotional reaction on his part. And I think the fact that his, as I have called him numerous times in the past, a Jersey brawler, I think the Jersey brawler in him came out and he really didn't stop and think. You know, he was trying to force Mexico to get on this thing with the immigration by penalizing them economically. And that's, I agree 100%, that's no way to do it. I find it interesting that the president can't sit down with the Mexican authorities and say, look, you guys, I mean, you just can't do this. So I think in that situation, that's not going to happen. But I think in that situation, the answer is relatively simple. And I think it's relatively simple. I'm going to go back to some opinions that I got with conversations with Charlotte Cusperson, who spent numerous time on the Mexican border, boots on the ground, reporting on that situation down there. It is a very, very critical situation, much I think, to the chagrin of the Democrats. I mean, the fact of the matter is you have people coming into our country who are simply breaking the law. And I think it's, in my opinion, in that issue, I think it's in the hands of the United States to simply stop the lawbreakers as opposed to threatening the entire country economically. Any opinion on that?
Well, I agree. That's yeah. That was, you know, my point, that that's what he should do. Look, what the president should have done early this year was to invoke executive authority, which is tenuous constitutionally, but it has been for the last several presidents, if everybody wants to be honest about it. Frankly, when you look at some of the things that the last few presidents claimed executive authority for and issued executive orders over, none of them were as legitimate a use of the power as that President Trump could have exercised early this year in saying, the hell with Congress, it's my job to protect our borders, and I'm going to do it, whether you like it or not. Sue me. And that's what he should have done. And instead, he thoroughly capitulated early this year when he had that fight that included the government shutdown, and the Democrats won. And that's why we still have this problem, which is only getting bigger. That's what the president should have done, or do something, frankly, of a military or security nature, even if he has to cooperate with Mexico. Now, again, going into this weekend, one of the things that Mexico is claiming to want to do is to take some of its national police force to the border and work with our border patrol. So maybe he's getting in a roundabout way what he wanted in the first place, and maybe he's outfoxing all of us with these tactics. Who knows? But, you know, on the trade thing, though, Al, I got to point out, they had the head of BMW interviewed earlier this week, and he was saying, look, I've spent a lot of money opening plants in the U.S. The average American doesn't realize that a BMW is as much made in America these days as a Chevy, if not more so. I also have opened plants in Mexico. Why are you penalizing me when I've been so good to your country? Good point.
That's a very good point. It's not a good point. That's an excellent point. I think the situation realistically, you have two very different labor and cost environments in the United States and Mexico, and I think that's something that we simply have to work around. There's no question right now about that. The big problem right now, and I kind of want to slip this over into the next segment so we have plenty of time to talk about it, but there's no question that the big problem right now is the economic situation with China. Valentin Schmidt from the Epoch Times sent me a really, really interesting article written by one of his colleagues that said those things, in the opinion of Valentin, are working right now. The penalties, the tariffs against China are apparently working because folks right now are looking for different supply chains, is the word that he used, as opposed to supply chains that include China. If that'll succeed, then who knows, maybe Trump was right in that one too. Any comments?
Well, again, I think I'm distinguishing, Al, between China and most of the rest of the trade battles or fights or whatever you want to call them that we've had. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very different kettle of fish where China's concerned. And again, it goes beyond trade in merchandise to things like technology and all of the stuff that has now been increasingly well covered in the media. So, yeah, in the next segment, we need to dive into that a little bit more and talk about just what's at stake and some of the potential reactions that we're seeing out of China. Some we're already getting a glimpse of, some they've threatened. We may be seeing a very abrupt reordering of the whole globalization regimen that we've had largely since World War II, which China had been brought into and now may be the first to leave.
You know what, we got to take a real quick break, Chris. Fortunately, we have another 8 minutes or more that we can talk about that. I think you bring up a very good point. Ladies and gentlemen, stick around. I'm going to be right back with the genius, Chris Temple.
your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome back. Continuing our discussion with Mr. T. Chris Temple, the genius. I have to say one thing. If you guys want to find out how much of a genius he is, take a look at his newsletter. I don't know if Chris is offering any kind of introductory offers right now, but if he is, we'll sure like give him the opportunity to talk about that. His newsletter is fantastic. Anyway, having said that, Chris, let's dive into this trade war as it pertains particularly between the United States and mainland China. You're on, bud.
Well, look, this is something that it wasn't that many weeks ago, going back only to the 1st of May, when it looked as though we were on the edge of a deal. And what some people were concerned about, myself included, was that President Trump was going to be too concerned about the perception of the markets and some of his political detractors and be too quick to sign a deal that on the surface would have done something to reduce our long-term merchandise trade deficit with China, but would have kicked the can down the road on so many other more important issues, whether it be forced technology transfers, cyber warfare, and a whole host of other things that have been well covered and well chronicled. And I believe the president and the narratives that we've seen in the media that China decided that they were going to call Trump's bluff and see if they could get him to capitulate on these other issues, as the last several U.S. presidents have done in one way or another. And he decided at the end of the day, no, I'm not going to do that. That this is the time and this is the place, and I am the president, that is going to force China to behave as the rest of our trading partners do in a transparent, fair, first world regimen. And kudos to him for that. I've always said that. So this is where we're at. And China, I think, was surprised that they could not roll Trump. They thought that he was so worried about having to see the Dow Jones average set new highs every week that he would not risk this longer term battle that we are now more fully engaged in with China. And China was wrong in its estimation of that. So where this leaves us now is in a very, very interesting place, because a lot of people have correctly pointed out that this is like, and I don't even know the best analogy to use, but I'll just say this, Al, that you have two wholly disparate cultures and economies and modes of legal redress when there are issues in law and economics and finance. And in a lot of these respects, the U.S. and China are poles apart in how we both operate. Doesn't mean one is good or one is bad. But when, under President Clinton, China was brought into the World Trade Organization with the promise that China wanted to act more like the West and act more like us, you go back those 25 or so years that it's been now, and have they really fulfilled that? Not very much. Their markets have opened a little bit. It's easier to buy Chinese securities. It's easier for Chinese securities to be listed on Western exchanges. But by and large, the culture of China has continued to go on. And again, that's not saying they're horrible and we're, you know, our you-know-what doesn't stink, because they're two different systems. And I think that this is helping to put the lie to the idea that people have had for years that you can blend all of these cultures, all these different economies into one kumbaya type of system of international finance, and everybody's going to get along happily ever after. So where this leaves us is that I think for their various reasons, and because, as I think you pointed out correctly so in the last segment, China's in really serious trouble right now as far as their financial and banking system is concerned. They cannot afford to go on much longer the way things are with this trade war going on. And I think the doomsday scenario that the markets would view as such anyway, that a lot of people aren't giving enough credence to as far as how possible it is, China may just up and say, if they can't get what they want, that, you know what, thanks for the invitation. Thanks for letting us be part of the World Trade Organization for the last quarter century. We tried, but you know what? We've got our way of doing things. You have your way of doing things. We're going to take a couple of steps backward and regroup, and we're going to come up with a different game plan as to how we're going to deal with other nations. That's very possible. And that's going to really upset the apple cart. Was that where we were heading eventually anyway? I think so. Because especially with all of the economies of the planet kind of bogging down, what happens during times like that is that you don't have more of a desire on the part of countries to cooperate and have free trade and so forth. You instead have more of a need to protect number one, to look out for number one. So-called protectionism, I hate that word, but for lack of a better one, that increases when economies weaken. And most countries do not buy the idea or the notion that the way to reverse these bad times is to have more and more free trade. You're looking out for yourselves because your voters want you, at least in this country and so forth. So it's really still a very much a moving and volatile target. This is not going to get solved easily no matter what happens. I think what the markets are hoping for, Al, if nothing else, is that President Trump and President Xi get together at the end of the month in Japan at the G20 meeting, and at least even if they agree to disagree, if they have a smile on their face and they're shaking hands and saying, you know what, we're still going to work, we still want to be friends, that might be a moral victory. We may not get much more than that anytime real soon.
Chris, I think that's a really good point, and I think something that we want to be very, very watchful of. You know, I have to say in the background that, not really in the background, but a thought that came to mind while you were talking is this whole mess that's going on right now between the two factions in the country, the pro-Trump and the anti-Trump. I have a very, very distinct feeling that the anti-Trump faction, quite frankly, doesn't give the guy enough credit, in the sense that he's a bull in a china shop when it comes to wanting to get things done. He wants instant gratification, and I think that's why he pulled that bonehead move with Mexico. He is frustrated, I would have to say, by what's going on, for example, right now between the United States and Mexico in terms of the illegal immigrants. The illegal immigrants, anybody would have to admit that, sure, it's a wonderful kumbaya, as you put it, thing to say, let's welcome everybody, but it simply is unaffordable, and it will bring down our country. It just makes me sad that more people won't look at really what Trump is saying and understand that, yeah, his communication, as I have said many times, stinks, but again, by the same token, his I think his thoughts and his intentions are very, very good. 20 seconds, Chris, wrap it up for us.
Well, look, I have also said that with the president, I'm a scorekeeper. If I like what he's doing, I'll say so. If I don't, I'll explain why. By and large, the man deserves a lot of credit for at least trying to right these wrongs that we've had that other presidents promised to do something about and didn't. We can quibble over the details. We'll continue to do that. But at least he's trying.
At least he's trying. Ladies and gentlemen, stick around. I'm going to be right back with a new guest.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome back. Continuing on with KER Politics. You know, today is kind of a red letter day for Big Al. Big Al has an old friend of his, a guy who he met a number of years ago. We used to do radio together, Michael Hartfield. Michael is a good guy. I haven't seen him for a long time. He's now making his home down in Central Oregon. Michael started Channel 12 News, was the weatherman on the Channel 12 News in Portland, Oregon, was a weatherman on the station in Eugene, Oregon. Michael and I had a very successful radio show for a while. Michael is perhaps more of a political junkie than I am, and he's going to be coming on the show probably a couple times a month, maybe not as long as he's on for today. Today we're going to devote the last half hour of the show to Mr. Hartfield. Michael, how you doing, bud?
I am well, Al. Just one correction. I was on the 10 o'clock news on, started that on KPTV, Channel 12 in Portland. and I did weather in Eugene. So you're right on that. But so I was in the news for a while.
There you go. And you did very well. Michael, I want to talk overall about some things that are going on right now in our country. I want to say politically and also philosophically. Now, you and I are roughly the same age. We've known each other for a long time. My contention, Mike, is that this whole thing in terms of the liberal movement, if it feels good, do it movement, et cetera, started probably back in the, I would say, early 60s. You know, I realized that we were in trouble economically when Fisher Volvo in Portland, Oregon, they were advertising you two in the Oregonian. They had full-page ads. You two can afford to drive a brand-new Volvo as we are now offering seven-year finance contracts. To me, that's the epitome of something for nothing. That's the epitome, in my opinion, of absolute irresponsibility from a fiduciary standpoint. I mean, you know, kids making back in those days maybe $75,000 to $100,000 a year. You know, they were going out and buying mega mansions because they could get finance. They were, you know, two Volvos in the driveway, et cetera, et cetera. And then look what happened come 2008. You know, we had a major collapse here. When do you think the degradation of moral values, Michael, really started in the United States?
Well, it seems to me, Al, that I was looking at a film last night of Woodstock. You remember Woodstock?
Oh, of course.
And they just the looks on their faces and the things they were saying. It was a bunch of young people who knew more than anybody else.
Right.
I mean, they had a license on the truth. And I think a lot of it started with that post-World War II baby boom generation. And I think it's carried forward. It's now metastasized, if you will. It's more now than it was then, and the current population. Well, wait a minute, Bob, let me back up. Those folks raised their children in that Dr. Spock style,
right?
Where all you do is encourage, no negativity, and then that helicopter parenting. Well, where the mother hangs over the kids all the time and says, "Don't do this and don't do that, and be careful, watch this," and the kid never learns consequences, thinks he always does very well, expects the world to be his stage, so to speak. I think all that came about in the last, you know, what, 40 or 50 years, but starting, I think, after the war.
You know, I have to agree with you on that one, Mike. After the war, I think perhaps is a little better date other than perhaps the early 60s. Although, you know, in the early 60s, in the Vietnam era, those were the days when the feel good, do it. If it feels good, do it. You know, damn the consequences, et cetera, et cetera. That's when it all started. I mean, that's about the time that the subject of free abortions got really, really big. That's about the time that cohabitating with your girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever started to become really big. And that's the time when personal debt in the United States, whether it's, you know, secured by an automobile, whether it's unsecured debt in the form of credit cards or what have you, that's about the time that all hell broke loose. And it took about 40 years, I would say, until about 2000 before that problem became very, very serious. You know, I was doing radio back in the 90s. You and I did some radio from, what, I guess, 1999 on, but back in the 90s, I was in Portland, Oregon, and I was doing what I would call beige business radio. By that, I mean I was interviewing, CEOs of companies, Boeing's, Microsoft, et cetera, with really no thought of the consequences of the actions that were going on right now. And I realized in about 1999, 2000, that it really, the United States society was really facing some very serious consequences. And the bottom fell out, really, I would have to say, in about 2007, 2008. anybody could get a mortgage on a house on the Columbia River, whatever they wanted, as long as they had some sort of income that, that could show, as long as they could make, damn near just make an X on a loan application, they could get credit for almost anything they wanted. You know, we talk about morality going in the toilet in the United States. Everybody immediately jumps to the conclusion of sexual immorality. But I want to talk with you first, Michael, about fiscal immorality, because that's what's killing this country. I mean, look at the debt today, man.
Well, Al, I remember 20 years ago, we were hearing that the amount of personal debt carried in America would sink the economy.
Right.
Well, it didn't quite do it. It didn't do it, but it was big then and it's big now. But you know, 2008 was that whole thing was very interesting. And generally, I think it's misunderstood. The government had a very strong role in that kind of indebtedness. Those mortgages came about because the government ordered the banks to make loans to people who could not pay them back.
Right.
And then they got interest groups to boycott the banks and hold them hostage if they wanted to grow the bank and build banks elsewhere. They would protest and they wouldn't be able to get it done if the bank didn't make these loans. Then they were in trouble with the public and with the government. So the government forced those loans, forced the banks to figure out how to deal with them when they packaged them in those securities and sold them. And then, of course, the bottom fell out. They fell apart because people couldn't afford the mortgages. Many of them had the clauses, you know, where they started out really cheap and then stepped up as time went on. And when they stepped up, they couldn't afford them.
Well, Michael,
but I think that was primarily government induced.
Do you remember back when I was a director of American Pacific Bank? I'm sure you do. But the interesting thing about those days is, being a director, I sat on the loan committee a number of times, and I remember some of the loan applications that came across to our committee. They were absolutely ridiculous. They were not based on anything. They weren't based on economic fundamentals. They were based on absolutely nothing other than perhaps race or gender. And you're right, we were absolutely forced by the Federal Reserve to make those loans. If we did not make the loans, we would have been in trouble. We would have experienced numerous fines. And I remember when our chairman, Fai Chan, who is now a highfalutin financier in Hong Kong, said, you know what, we're going to sell the bank. This is stupid. This cannot last. And you know what? We did sell the bank. And many of the banks in the Portland area had serious problems. We all did not have a serious problem because we were no longer the owners of the bank. Ladies and gentlemen, stick around. I'm going to be right back with my friend Michael Hartfield. Hey, welcome back here to wrap up KER Politics. I want to segue from what Mike and I were chatting about, and I got to tell you, Mike's right on in what he's saying, and you know how I feel about this. I've been talking about this for the last 2 or 3 years, but I want to segue into what our president is trying to do, Donald Trump. I think that he is simply trying to get us back to basics, and I think that's the only thing that will save this country. Globalism is definitely not going to save this country, and that seems to be what everybody else wants. But I don't think it's going to work in this point. First of all, Mike, give me your opinion on Trump, would you?
Sure. I think Trump is doing a very good job in almost all areas. He tweets too much for most people. They don't like it. He is apparently has a philosophy of when he's hit, he hits back. And most people like the notion of just when you get hit as a president, you just shut up and turn the other cheek. That did not work for George W. Bush, by the way. He got badly damaged because he kept turning the other cheek until he was down to about 35% in the polls. But I think he's done a very good job. I think he wants to stop this illegal immigration. I think it's very difficult for him to do it. Obviously, he hadn't been able to do it at all. The current threat to Mexico on the tariffs, I think, is being... I think that will work, by the way, because I think Mexico can't afford tariffs. So I would say I'm going to give him high grades for almost everything he's tried to do in terms of fighting terrorism, keeping Iran in check, helping Israel, getting the tax cuts through in the economy. I have no complaint.
What do you think about what he's trying to do with Israel, Mike?
Well, I think he's working very hard to get some kind of... He's got his son-in-law working over there trying to get some kind of a peace between those two nations, Israel and Palestine. That's a can of worms. They had it solved at one time when Clinton was president, and the Palestinians turned it down, even though they were given everything they wanted.
Yeah,
so
you've
got to ask yourself, do they really want an answer?
I don't disagree at all with that. You know, it's funny. I read something interesting yesterday, or maybe it was a day. It was yesterday, actually, in the paper. Seattle Times, you know, the paper to hundreds of thousands of homeless people. Having said that, let me just say that they chastised Donald Trump for saying that, in his opinion, the mayor of London was a stone-cold fool. Loser, I believe, is a word that he used.
Right,
you know,
right.
And you know, the Dems, the progressives, whatever, just went nuts. How can the president of the United States possibly say something like that about the mayor of London, who happens to be Islamic, by the way? It's my understanding, and you may even know the numbers better than I do, but I think the Islamic folks are literally in the process of taking over the British Isles right now. Any comment on that?
I think that's true. I think it'll work this way. They get a majority, or not a majority, I'm sorry. They get enough for a coalition so that they can impact, they and somebody else can be a majority. And that's going across through Europe now with all the immigration. And they will take over institutions first, and then they will eventually get control of governments. Why would an Islamic man be the mayor of London? Just ask yourself. They've got to have enough votes to make that happen. So, I believe Europe, I think, is largely, well, I would say it's going to be an Islamic nation.
Give me a period of time, Michael.
Oh, I think it's going to take probably 25 years before they get enough power. And as I say, you don't have to have a majority. They have to have enough to join with another group to be a majority coalition, and then they've got power. So it'll take probably 20 or 25 years before they get enough people to make that happen. But they'll do it just like they do in Minneapolis. They brought these Somalis over there, and now they've got a representative in Congress from that district. And she's tearing up the fabric of America with her comments, as I'm sure you've heard.
Sure.
But that's the way it'll be done, little by little by little.
Well, they're not stupid people. There's no question about that. I mean, it's interesting, you know, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, et cetera, they're all part of what I would call the Abrahamic covenant. But having said that, I think what's interesting is the fact that we got a president right now. We have a president right now who I think sees the writing on the wall. He's not sophisticated in the sense that he is a Jersey brawler, but he's pretty well self-made. I mean, a lot of people have said, well, he became a millionaire because he had a huge nest egg that was given to him by his father. Well, the fact of the matter is, he took that nest egg and turned himself into one of the richest, most influential people in the world. He's not stupid, and he tells it like it is. And I really wonder, you know, I was chatting with David Horowitz last week, and you mentioned you'd read a lot of David's books, but David feels, as I do, that if the Democrats, and I'm going to call them socialistic Democrats, happen to get into the executive branch in 2020, I think this country is going to be in very serious trouble. And I pray to God, Michael, honest to God, I help the people like you and I can put him back, can put Donald Trump back in the White House. Give me some comments.
Well, I think he will be put back in the White House. I don't think there's anybody out there right now who threatens him. I just think if we, you know, I do want to make a statement here. I don't want to condemn all Islamists by any means. It's the radical faction. And that's the concern. And I think they hold enough power that they keep the middle of the roaders quiet. And you know, to some degree, I can understand that. Something may happen pretty bad to you and your family if you speak up. So there's a good reason to be quiet about it. But I think, speaking of Trump, I think he probably will be put back in. Speaking of the mayor of London, you know, I was an advisor to Bob Straub when he was governor of Oregon. And if it had come up to me, I would have said, Governor Straub, I would not comment on what the mayor of London said. You know, just keep it quiet. He's too small a fish to mess with. But Trump goes his own way. I can't imagine his advisors suggested he do that.
I personally don't think that Donald Trump really listens particularly strongly to his advisors. Let me ask you one last question, Mike. We got about 2 minutes left here. My question is, he seemed to not be able to hold his staff together. Is that a negative comment on him, or is that a positive comment on him, him being Trump?
You know, that's hard to say. All presidents have a lot of staff turnover. I mean, if you could imagine the amount of stress and the work involved being on that staff.
Yep.
You get ground up. I mean, a year of that is about a lot. So I think people are ready to leave after a short period of time. And oftentimes they get at odds with the president, you know, because they're men of strong or women of strong opinion, and so is he. Remember, he's only put people on there who've had business experience. 80% of his staff has had corporate experience.
Right.
9% of Obama's staff was corporate experience. That's a huge difference.
Well, there's a huge difference, obviously, between former President Obama and President Donald Trump. There's a huge difference. On the one hand, you had what I would call a closet socialist, perhaps even a closet communist. And on the other hand, you've got a very forthright, very bold individual who I really do think is looking out for the U.S. of A. Ladies and gentlemen, I guarantee you I'm going to get Mr. H back on the show here. He's a good guy. He's fun to talk to. Let me know what you think about his opinions. See you next week.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.